Good evening, everyone. Another Thursday evening, March. And the calendar turns, the clock turns. The earth turns, the clouds drift. And yet, we still have greed, anger, ignorance all around, the three poisons. And sometimes it's a sunny day and there is killing, and sometimes it's a cloudy day and there is caring. There's no rule, really. No fixed pattern to any of it, except the basic roots that we know give rise to pain and suffering. Or joy and happiness, comfort. And what I find so extraordinary is this practice of ours, Zen in particular, but Buddhism in the bigger scheme. We hear all about political, we have a elections in France on Sunday, municipal elections. And there's all these different political parties and positions and accusations and kind of really fixed ideas about. There's a lot of what we call othering, which means, or this deep conditioning we have of separation, hierarchy, fear. Who we trust, who we distrust, who we think belongs, who we think doesn't belong, all these things. And this is verbalized and demonstrated in these political positions and policies that are in the forefront now for different, in every city they're electing officials. Someone from our Sangha is actually running in the elections, Adrien, in his village, which has a population of, I think, 700, his village. And he is number two on the list. Someone else will be the mayor if they're elected, but Adrien would be like the deputy mayor or something. Of course, in a village like that, these deep conditionings of separation and othering and political parties are very different. It's more of everybody is a part of the village and who has the idea of how better they should set up the sewer system or, what kind of Adrien is on the committee within his list for like well-being and health and things like that. So what kinds of things will each of the lists, they're not related to parties, what will they promote, right? So the more people we get, usually the more complicated it gets. And the bigger the egos get. We can also have in a village that size, and I think there are villages around who are politicized. And actually, on the far right in his region, but it doesn't have to be that way, right? We don't have to have these extreme attachments to other and divisions of things. So we're, this is present in France this week. We see on the wider scale war, never ending. There's always some war and someone attacking someone else and insulting people and creating suffering and destruction, all this. So what to come back to what is so radical about our practice and about Buddhism in general, but Zen in particular, is it's really a revolution because it's not about changing borders or regimes, so we're not interested in regime change or borders, like this, we should put this border here or that. What we're interested in is changing hearts, which is very different. And changing hearts in order to act not from fear, but from love, or not from delusion about separation, but from the wisdom of oneness. That changes everything, if we act from that place. And sometimes it's interesting. There was on the metro yesterday in Paris. I came down to get onto the train, and the train was kind of stopped there. And as I was coming, someone was going up the steps, and they said, "Oh, there's a problem. It's stuck." So I got on the train anyway. And in the car where I got on, there was a little crowd gathered around, and there were some security people from the metro who were there, and I realized they were trying to get someone off the train. And when there was all this commotion going on, and when they pulled him off and put him on a seat on the platform, you could see the guy was probably, he was kind of like a homeless guy. He was probably really had drunk a lot of alcohol or some kind of substance, I don't know. He could barely sit up by himself. And so then the train went, and I heard a couple of these guys talking who had helped, or at least were involved in whatever happened. And I heard one of them say, "Well, we don't know what happened to him. Maybe he just wanted to sleep on the floor." And the other one said, "Yeah, but clearly he looked like he drank too much." But there was that really struck me, that one of these guys was actually said, "Maybe he just wanted to lay down on the floor in the metro and we should have left him," Which I thought, that's such a strange, that's not really acting from a place of compassion, Who would actually want to lay down in the metro at rush hour? And then when they tried to get him to get up, would be unable to get up by himself. Clearly, there was something not well, And this guy was claiming that they shouldn't have gotten involved. And we know this very well. Oh, I'm not going to get involved. It's not my place. Who am I to say? This is a delusion, right? I mean, in some cases that might be the truth. But if we're acting from a place of heart, then we won't have that same reflex to say, "Oh, it's not my business. It's not my place." Especially if we see suffering. And there is no fixed answer about how we should behave. And it's not, our precepts give us guides, but that's not a fixed response either. And it's not ideological, it's existential. It's a way of seeing, a way of being, that a way of relating with others from a place of compassion and empathy, rather than from a place of separation and not caring, actually. Because in that, the guy who was saying, "Well, maybe he just wanted to stay there on the ground," there was something not caring about that. If the guy was not able to respond, then clearly there was something happening there, some kind of suffering going on there. And they weren't having an argument, these guys. It was like an exchange of views, and they were almost laughing about it, which was a relief in a sense, because you could think, well, maybe that whole new, fight would involve, would arise from that, and they would argue and fight and, something like that. But they didn't. But so our, the Buddha's teaching is, look into the intention behind our actions. So what is the intention of saying, well, maybe we should have just left him there. Maybe he wanted to stay there. Where is that coming from? And or where is the thing of saying, no war, no fighting, force, we know force can be driven by compassion. We can, they forcibly picked this man up from the floor of the metro and carried him out, and it took a couple of big guys to carry him out. That was coming from a place of compassion. No one was angry with him or anything. Or, a surgeon, right? A surgeon has to cut. A surgeon cuts the body, cuts the skin, but it's coming from a place of compassion to heal. Or a parent who, tells their child, don't do that. My grandson yesterday was looking at me and climbing on top of the table in the living room, the low table. And he knows he's not supposed to do that. But he was looking at me to see what I would do, And I said, no, and then he climbed up there and he was kneeling. And I said, no, you don't do that. You know you're not supposed to do that. And then he was going to stand up. And he right away said, Maman. So in his head, he associates, I'm not supposed to do this, with his mother telling him he's not supposed to do it, right? And I said, exactly. Maman says no. It's different if I say no, but and he got down. But this is like, endless. And it's not because I want to be mean to him or I want to hurt him. It's the opposite. It's coming from a place of not wanting him to get me hurt, of teaching him that, there are things you do and you don't do. And the reason is not because you're bad or because we don't want you to do it because we don't want you to have fun or something. It's because we don't want you to harm yourself or others, So in any situation, we can ask ourselves, how can I, in this moment, in this position, in this role that I have? So I have the role of the grandmother. I mean, even if I wasn't the grandmother, I probably would have told him not to do it because he could hurt himself, he could fall, and they don't want the kid climbing on the furniture, right? So makes sense. How do we act in whatever our position is, whatever our role is? And so the revolution of Buddhism too is that it doesn't, it recognizes different roles and positions. So it recognizes that there is a teacher and that there's a student and that there's a king and that there's a president and that there's a shopkeeper and that there's a policeman and that there's a metro conductor that recognizes all the positions. There's an adult, there's a child. It sees the differences and it recognizes these different roles. But what it's saying is, pointing to, is to see the oneness that underlies all of this so that our actions can be infused with, sometimes we say mindfulness, but from awareness and compassion, whatever your role is. And we see all around us what happens when that isn't taken into consideration. If we see the if we see the extreme delusion and confusion of just the war in the Middle East, so are these is the strategy? There doesn't seem to really be any strategy, but is the strategy rooted in a place of oneness and protecting life, of l aiming for lasting welfare? Or is it based in the trauma and the f anger of, in Israel's case of the October 7th, in the US case of whatever, there's a million things the US could use as an excuse, right? Is it based on trauma of past conflicts or even trauma of the persons that are behind this? There are all kinds of traumas in their childhood or whatever, is the aim to secure peace? Or is it to simply assert their dominance? To be in charge, to take control. With, saying the pretext is that if I take control, there will be peace. That's obviously something like that. Although no one has talked at all about peace since this whole thing started 2 weeks ago or whatever. No one is talking about it on any of the sides, about lasting peace or welfare, or something. So we see this, oh, that's the macro view is, war like that. Or, the micro view of in your community, riding on the public transport or in your classrooms or your workplaces or your villages at the cafe, whatever. Are we cultivating a mind free of hatred and greed, anger, and ignorance? Or are we cultivating a mind of love, wisdom, compassion, generosity? It really it's just phenomenal how we see it all and how clear that the Buddhist teaching is. There was this revolution. The Buddhist teaching is just revolutionary. It's like a compass, do my actions reduce suffering or do they perpetuate it? Am I feeding the fire with more fire? Which that seems like a pretty clear one, when there are fires, and in Portugal, you know this very well, that no one would feed that fire with fire. They might use fire, they might burn some land, in a special line so that the fire cannot progress beyond that. That's a tactic that's used. But no one who had in mind the well-being of the planet, the towns, the people, no one would feed that fire with more fire. It's just so obvious. Unless, and this, we know happens, often these fires are intentionally started, but that's coming from a place of someone is troubled. Someone is not coming from a place of wholeness and oneness and love when they intentionally start fire. And so we can see it literally not feeding the fire with fire. And we can see, on a global scale of feeding the fire with, massive drone attacks and intercontinental missiles and all kinds of fire, right? So like if we take the example of the surgeon, she is not coming from a place of hurt, hatred and harm. The surgeon is coming from a place of compassionate wanting to heal and help. And I don't know, I can't imagine what that must be like to cut into someone's body. I don't know. And deeply sometimes, a brain surgeon or a heart surgeon, that's like, deep cutting. It's not coming from a place of hatred. It's not coming from a place of greed. You can say, okay, they might want to do this job because they get a lot of money. But there's other ways to earn money that you don't have to cut into someone's body, right? At least that's the ideal of the doctor, is that someone who wants to heal, not do harm. They even take the oath, the Hippocratic oath, which doesn't guarantee anything, but that it's a sign that this is someone who is, acting from a place of wanting to help rather than do harm. We can all look at, our conditioning of separation and hierarchy and fear and difference and distrust. I read about this French woman who's of Algerian origin, but she was born in France, and maybe her parents were even born in France. I don't know. Probably her parents were born in France. But her parents every Saturday sent her to school, a special school, to learn to speak Arabic. And she didn't let, she hated it. She because she didn't speak to her, literally. It just was not her way of being, it was just didn't speak to her. And her father never wanted to go back to Algeria for I don't know for what reason. But so the reason she wrote a book about, so her father died, and for some reason he wanted to, or the family thing was that to bring his body back to Algeria to have him buried there in Algeria in the village where his family was from. And it was a huge ordeal to get a special passport, and you have to have authorization and all of this stuff. And she just kept thinking, why are we doing this? This is just crazy. But she did it for him. And so she went back. And when she got there, she didn't know anything about the rituals, the traditional things that people were doing around death and mourning and all of this. And so she really had to learn it all. And she was treated, they called her this word in Arabic that she didn't know. And she found out what it meant was la Française, the French one, the French woman, right? So here she comes back to her father's homeland, and she's treated like she's a foreigner, right? And when she heard that, she thought, well, in France, I'm not really treated like a French woman, although she is French, but because she has an Algerian name, and France is just rife with racism and othering, although she's educated and she's not, she doesn't wear traditional, she doesn't cover her head, she doesn't wear traditional clothing, anything. She looks like just anyone else. No, she's French, right? And so that's really interesting, right? So in one place, she's not considered Algerian, and the other place, she's not considered French. So who is she? And we see how deep this othering goes. She said she didn't feel like the Algerians were thinking of her as bad because she was French, whereas in France, sometimes they think of the Algerians as bad. But she was clearly seen as different. And that's really a deep, but that's deep conditioning that we have, right? That the other, who doesn't look like me, who doesn't talk like me. I know a lot. I mean, I'm othered all the time in France. I have an accent. So clearly, I'm not French, right? I speak French very well, but I have an accent. And I notice people notice, it can be very subtle, but people notice. Is there distrust that comes from that when people hear that I have an accent? Probably not. Not as far as I know, but there's probably something really deep suited, deeply seated in them of other. So our practice is telling us something else, not other. One. Not closed, open, right? Not fixed, not attaching to identities or positions or beliefs. And then looking into in ourselves, where is this coming? Where do we hold these beliefs, or where do we become stuck, or when do we act from a place of not wholeness, from separation? And do our actions reduce suffering, or do they perpetuate it, basically? So maybe I'll stop there and for the moment and see if you have anything to share or comment or question.
Hello, everyone. Good night. I was thinking here of how a wellness of heart and mind to do that, to live an enlightened life. Fully in just, and without a separation from each moment, each person, and how we, most of the time we can't do that, and the qualities like those you mentioned, Amy, generosity, compassion, that we can generate even if we can't live it fully, like awareness and mindfulness, to at least don't lose completely the way and not follow the fire when it gets, if being it desire or anger or whatever, to not add fire to the fire. And yeah, and that's it's a practice every moment, every day. But it needs a, it seems that it needs a determination to, if not, we are always losing sight of what's really happening in this. Okay, it's just sharing. Thank you.
Yes, it does. It does require determination or discipline or Remembering what our vow is, to save all sentient beings, or however you want to formulate your vow, it does require that, an effort. And yet we realize that it doesn't really take very much effort. Our practice is about sitting, letting things come up, let them go, come up, let go. And then very naturally, there's not much effort involved in that, generally. And then at times there is, but it's easier to make that effort then because we've trained in this letting things arise and fall away and rise and fall away. But it's true, yeah. What is our motivation? What is our bottom line determination?
Just to add something. I find that it's true. There's not much, most of the time, there's not much need of effort if we have determination and discipline. Because if we don't have it, our resistances catch the way and we slip. But the thing is to be with attention to that, how it's ourselves that go away from the way by just distraction, because the resistance is strong to be really present, but it's a practice. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
An English psychoanalyst, I think, I read recently him talking about in a relationship, specifically, a love relationship, the difference between surrender and submission. And this applies also to our own path, right? That in often we confuse that when we become involved in a relationship with someone, we have to submit, and it can take the form of something that's transactional. So I will do this for you, but in exchange, I want you to love me. Or I'm going to save you from whatever, this thing that happens often. I'm going to be the savior in the relationship, save the other one who needs help, who's lost, or something. And in exchange, they will love me. And then the other is in a position of having to give something to make the other one happy. And there's no actual, it, there is, we think of it as transactional, but there's not actually any exchange of true. Of ourself, a real opening and a freely loving relationship. Whereas surrender, when we surrender ourselves, when both parties surrender themselves, then it's wide open and everyone receives and everyone gives. He's talking specifically in a loving relationship. But if we think of it in terms of ourselves, so we think in our, sometimes there's Zen teachers who talk about submission, You have to submit to the teacher. I have one particular in mind which talks about that, but you have to submit, submit, submit. And it becomes this thing where it's like you have to like make yourself smaller, become low down. The other one is all powerful and it's hierarchical and there's a lot of hitting, and things like that. Whereas actually, the thing is, you surrender to your true self. You don't surrender, you don't submit to anything or anyone. You surrender to your true self. You give up the self that is your idea, your opinion, your fixed position, your conditioning, what we call the small self sometimes. And in the, if we approach our practice from that place, rather than, oh, I have to do this, someone's expecting me to do this, I'm under pressure to do this. People who have that in their practice, they usually leave. They don't stay. And I've seen this like throughout my 30 some years of practice before I was a teacher, but also since teaching. That often people drop their practice if they feel like they have to submit to something, whether it's submit to a teacher, submit to a teaching, submit to a practice, submit to a way of being or something. Whereas people who see it as a surrender to themselves, maybe they will go away too, but they go away for a different reason, you know? It may not be their practice. Whereas people who see it as submission, of course they resist. And I'm glad they do, because it's not about that. It's not about submission. And that changes then our determination, that changes our motivation about what we're doing. It opens the possibility for wholeness within our own selves and then with others. Because then in our communities, then we're not treating each other from a place of submission either. And we're not trying to make the others submit to our will or submit to the way we see things. And then, like in this love relationship that the psychoanalyst was talking about, then it's wide open and everyone's free. And there's no kind of transactional thing going on.
Good evening, everyone. In the examples you were just giving, Roshi, I noticed that there was this recurring word, I have to submit to, I have to do this, that caught my attention. My go-to place lately, is who is this about? Especially at work, I'm mostly thinking in the workplace. Who is this about? Is this about me? And it's not that, oh no, this is not about me. This is about the student or whatever. It's not like that, but paying attention to this question, this kind of question, it opens up the something changes or something can change just by asking this question. Immediately something is different. Yeah, it's not that the answer or the way of doing it becomes clear or something. But But yeah, that's been my question lately, many times. You know, who is this about? Am I making this about me? You know, so it's been very very helpful. It opens up something. Opens up something, yeah. Some space, maybe. Thank you.
Yes, that's an example of, you know, that takes you to, well, what's the motivation behind whatever this is, you know, exactly. Krisha.
Good evening, everyone. This is not directly, it's just about the Dharma talk. Just wanted to share today, I was going on my site construction journey and listening to the radio, I about the war and about the Euribor taxes, the interest of the houses that in Portugal are going to rise within the next week. I immediately wanted to start it to cry, and just felt the anxiety returning. I think I've shared with you that I'm having a practice, or playing a bit with the idea of today is the best day of my life, day, every day. And then I remember that today is the best day of my life, and I was thinking, what the fuck is great about this? And well, it was a bit difficult, and I thought, yeah, it gives you again the opportunity to deal with stuff that really gives you anxiety and really puts you in a bad place. It's life. Oh, the idea, at least for me, of today is the best day of my life day practice is not to be merry, it's to be fully in the present. But my present was that, and I don't want to be there. And it is tricky because I cannot control life, of course. The world is going completely crazy, and we got the Russians, we got Trump, we got Israel, we got now Iran. We don't see a way out of this, and this is going to have a big impact, and is having, and it's still going, and this impacts people's lives, everyone's. But then it's to be there, and I don't know, 2, 3 years ago, I just felt that I cannot deal no more with life. I give up. And I have kids, and this was really shocking for me to stress so much with something that my answer is no more. And that's why I wanted to cry, because I don't want to be there again. But I don't know what is going to happen, how it's going to affect me, or how am I going to deal. But yeah, for me to look was okay, don't look to the one thing is your reaction, the felt one. One thing it's what is happening, and you know what is happening. It's not a reason for you to deal so badly with the question. That is a condition. That is a condition that something happened when you were young, and you think that's threatening, and you want to give up. So let's see. And today is my best day, the best day of my life. This in English is not so easy. And thank you.
When we look at it from, one perspective, we can't stop the war, we can't bring down the price for petrol, we can't do anything, right? Then we are completely just one ball of anxiety and paralysis, So that what our teaching, what our practice is telling us is it's right here, like you say, it's this moment. What in this moment, in this place where I am, how can I act from a place of wholeness, love, wisdom, instead of a place of separation, fear, whatever? Doesn't mean that it's obvious, but that's where our practice takes us here. Like you say, right now in this moment. So in this moment, in that moment you were talking about, that's what it was. You kind of broke up, so I wasn't clear exactly what you said about you heard the radio about the war and then something, 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 and you broke up a little bit. So was it about gas prices or something?
No interest, the bank.
Oh, the bank interest. Okay. Right. Another thing you can't control.
Yeah, the next week in Portugal for loans.
You can't control.
You
Exactly.
can't.
And so how are you going to pay that? You don't have a choice, you have to do it, and everybody's in the same boat, so the bank is not going to make an exception for you. Whatever. So then that's what your moment is. And your little slogan of this is the best moment of my life, that can be helpful. It's the only moment in your life, actually. So it's the best. It's the only one there is, So
Thank you.
thank you.
It's a courageous way of living the pra of living in the practice, Krisha.
Absolutely, Yeah, this practice takes courage. It really does. But the rewards, like I always say, are beyond anything else I can imagine. For you and for others.
It's wonderful to hear you all. And I agree that this practice takes courage, but right now, quite frankly, without this practice would take more courage, I think. I have always maintained that I'm totally crazy, but I've never been depressed. And I think it was last week, last Monday, not the one that we just had, but the one before, when I woke up, I knew a moment of what felt like total despair, which is probably was probably set into motion by the, I mean, some of the places that are being bombed are some of my favorite places in the whole world, and it really does, it makes me feel terribly sad. But it's also my own despair that I just don't pay any attention to most of the time because I find something else to do, sort of. So it was the two met each other. And I think without practice, I couldn't handle that really. So it takes a lot of courage to live without practice, but to live with practice, but it takes a lot more courage to live without practice, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it has certainly made a difference in my life, in terms of, when I was working as a journalist, I had to really pay attention to all of this horror going on in the world. And I had to really know about it and go into the details. I couldn't turn away, or not really look into it. The madness. So we say the world has gone completely mad. Well, it's always been mad. It's just different madness at this moment, but it's actually the same madness. It's always from the same root. So, and I tell you that it really has, I know, it changed completely how I experience it. It doesn't change that there's, it's just, it's so unbelievable that the US is just doing this again, after Afghanistan and Iraq, Vietnam, and it's just amazing that it's happening again. But I know that my practice helped me when it was Afghanistan, and it helped me when it was Iraq. It helped me experience it differently and then be in this moment and not become paralyzed by anxiety or fear or something. And then behave differently with those around me. Well, if no one has anything else to act, Ed, we're almost out of time. This was nothing revolutionary, this talk, but yet it's just reminding us of the revolution of the heart that is our practice every moment. Well, thank you.